my dear brothers and sisters. About our converse, the Lord has two things to say which are very simple, but very weighty. The first is that it's completely known. The second is that its consequences to ourselves are inescapable. The first arises as a natural corollary from the doctrine of the immanence of God. Am I a God afar off and not a God nigh at hand? Can any hide himself in secret places that I should not see him? So Jeremiah, whither shall I flee from thy spirit, or whither shall I go from thy presence? So the psalmist. And yet the contexts of those two statements, which are almost identical, are quite different. In Jeremiah, it is a threatened judgment on false prophets and faithless pastors. In the psalmist, it's the all-protecting and prevailing love of God for one who is himself a godly man. Clearly, the same fact can mean two quite different things to two different people. Hence we have the Lord saying in Luke chapter 12, beware ye of the leaven of the Pharisees, which is hypocrisy. The one thing to be avoided is insincerity. For there's nothing covered that shall not be revealed, neither hid that shall not be known. And you remember that Paul takes language similar to this into his own letters, first to the Romans, where he speaks of a day in which God shall judge the secrets of men by Jesus Christ. And when he is having to defend his own authority elsewhere in the letter to the Corinthians, he speaks of God bringing to light the hidden things of darkness and making manifest the counsels of the heart. And then he says, shall every man have his praise of God? So the doctrine of the knowledge, the complete knowledge of our converse, is not intended to be terrifying to those whose lives are genuine and not hypocritical. It strikes a note of praise. It's something glad and happy for them that their ways are completely known by God. Then shall every man have his praise. And the language of the 139th Psalm is quite comparable to this, when the psalmist rejoices in the fact that God knows all his ways and has been wondrously good to him. But it does make the question of our conversation an important one, especially when the Lord goes further. Shall we turn to his statement on the question of the importance of our conversation in the day of judgment, which occurs in the 12th chapter of Matthew's record. And here at verse 36 he says, but I say unto you, that every idle word that men shall speak, they shall give account thereof in the day of judgment. For by thy words thou shalt be justified, and by thy words thou shalt be condemned. Whichever class you belong to, one or other of these final decisions, the Lord as arbiter will make in relation to your conversation, he says. By thy words thou shalt be justified, or by thy words thou shalt be condemned. The statement seems to be almost terrifying, that for every idle word we shall speak, we shall give account thereof in the day of judgment. At least it used to be to some of us in very early years. The context, however, I think shows what is meant. There have been some attempts to escape the significance of the word idol. I think you'll find it even in some of our most respectable literature, where the word injurious has been substituted for the word idol. This is of days gone by I am speaking. And yet there seems no justification for this. The word really means idol. It's the word rendered barren in the epistle of Peter. It's a word rendered idle in the parable of those laborers in the marketplace who had not been employed, had not been taken on for employment. Why stand ye idle all the day long? But it means quite simply idle or unprofitable. But the context of this passage shows quite clearly what Jesus means. He says in verse 33, either make the tree good and his fruit good, or else make the tree corrupt and his fruit corrupt. For the tree is known by its fruit. The good man out of the good treasure of the heart bringeth forth good things. And an evil man out of the evil treasure of the heart bringeth forth good things. And it is because a man's words are the index of his character. Because a good tree will inevitably produce good fruit, and a bad tree, bad fruit, that his words become important in the final decision as to his destiny. Take a man whose converse is idle and unprofitable, you will find his life is also like that from the divine angle. Take a man whose converse is rich, helpful, and upbuilding in the things of God, and it is because his life is an attempt to be that also. The words are a key to the living. There may be an attempted hypocrisy, of course. It will scarcely veil the real character from a discerning eye. Certainly not from the eye of the Father or his appointed, his Son, the appointed judge. The importance of a control over our speech, brethren and sisters, I think emerges very clearly in the book of Deuteronomy, which we are still passing through now. The whole tenor of that book is that Israel may not make the fault of their fathers who perished in the wilderness. Moses is afraid that an increase of sinful men has sprung up in the place of their fathers who will be no better than they and come to the same disastrous end. And into the book of Deuteronomy, which is simply a record of his final speech to the nation before he dies, there goes the whole of his own experience in a speech that is full of dynamic power, the value of which I think we lose very much because of the broken way in which we read it. It's well worth our while to read it as a whole, in addition to the doing of our daily readings. But one of the most poignant features of that speech lies in the references which Moses makes to the event which had prevented his own entrance into the promised land. I don't know whether you've noticed, but no less than 5 times in the course of this speech, Moses adverts to the fact that he is not allowed to enter the land because of his trespass. And it lies very heavy on his mind. I wonder if we've time just to glance at these very quickly. You'll find the first, in the first chapter of the book of Deuteronomy, in the opening of this speech, in which he draws attention to the fact that he was so very severely punished because of the importance of the position which he occupied as leader of the nation. It was for your sake, he said, that the Lord forbade me an entry. You'll find this first allusion in the 37th verse of chapter 1. Also the Lord was angry with me for your sakes, saying, thou shalt not go in thither. But Joshua, the son of Nun, which standeth before thee, he shall go in thither, encourage him, for he shall cause Israel to inherit it. And to Moses was given that most difficult of tasks, to an old man who had cherished an ideal throughout his life of bringing this nation into the land of promise and entering it himself, this was forbidden him because of what we should look upon perhaps as quite a minor trespass. He spoke when he should have been silent. He struck where he should have spoken. The Lord was angry with me for your sake, saying, thou shalt not go in thither, but Joshua the son of Nun. And he has the task of handing over his charge and encouraging or strengthening Joshua to achieve a work that God has forbidden him to complete. We may see the divine wisdom when we look at the whole purpose of removing at that juncture Moses from the scene. But it was a hard and bitter pill for Moses to swallow at this stage. If you turn over to the third chapter, you'll find him reverting to this matter once more. He said, I besought the Lord, verse 23, at that time, saying, O Lord God, thou hast begun to show thy servant thy greatness, thy mighty hand. For what God is there in heaven or in earth that can do according to thy works and according to thy might? I pray thee, let me go over and see the good land which is beyond Jordan, that goodly mountain and Lebanon. But the Lord was wroth with me for your sakes, and would not hear me. And the Lord said unto me, let it suffice thee, speak no more unto me of this matter. Get thee up into the top of Pisgah, lift up thine eyes westward, northward, southward, and eastward, and behold it with thine eyes, for thou shalt not go in thither. Thou shalt not go over this Jordan, but charge Joshua and encourage him. We turn to the next chapter and find him still harping upon this same theme in verse 21. Furthermore, the Lord was angry with me for your sakes and swear that I should not go over Jordan, that I should not go in unto that good land which the Lord thy God giveth thee for an inheritance, but I must die in this land. I must not go over Jordan. But ye shall go over and possess that good land. Take heed to yourselves, therefore, lest ye forget the covenant of the Lord your God which he made with you and make you a graven image. And time and again Moses uses this incident as a powerful lever to Israel to make them realize the importance of not forgetting their obligations to God. For it was a moment of forgetfulness that caused Moses the loss of this favor of completing the work which he had carried through for no less than 40 years, and which in the first 40 years of his life he had entertained undoubtedly as an ambition. If you turn to the 8th chapter, there is a beautiful oblique allusion, I think, to the fact that Moses had learned his lesson over this incident. He had failed to glorify God. He had not been obedient to him. He had, as the psalmist said, spoken unadvisedly with his lips. When in verse 11 he tells Israel, beware that thou forget not the Lord thy God in keeping his commandments and his judgments and his statutes which I command thee this day. And surely here's a lesson for our time. If any ancient lesson was applicable to our own day, this one is. Beware that thou forget not the Lord thy God, lest when thou hast eaten and art full, and hast built goodly houses and dwelt therein, when thy herds and thy flocks multiply, and thy silver and thy gold is multiplied, and all that thou hast is multiplied, then thine heart be lifted up, and thou forget the Lord thy God, which brought thee forth out of the land of Egypt from the house of bondage. They were entirely dependent on him, first for their delivery, later for their sustenance, who led thee through that great and terrible wilderness wherein were fiery serpents and scorpions and drought, where there was no water, who brought forth thee forth water out of the rock of flint. No more here now, ye rebels, must we fetch water out of this rock for you. Moses has learned his lesson. It was God who there stood at the mount and gave his own instructions, stood at the rock and gave his own instructions to Moses. Speak to the rock, it shall pour forth water. But Moses spoke to Israel in anger. Not that they didn't merit it, but it was a breach of the divine counsel in this case, and it failed to glorify God. I don't think that Moses placed an accent on the word we. when he said, "Must we bring forth out of this rock for you?" It would be utterly foreign to the nature of Moses. But he did fail to glorify God in that incident. And here it is, and Moses has this penalty to pay for it. And his record cannot close without yet one more allusion to it in the 31st chapter, Deuteronomy chapter 31. Moses went and spake all these words unto all Israel, and said unto them, "I am 120 years old this day. I can no more go out and come in. The Lord hath said unto me, Thou shalt not go over this Jordan." You see how deeply Moses felt this fact of his inability to complete his work. How serious a blow it was to him personally. Won't matter, of course, in the long run of things. He is sure of his inheritance finally in the eternal kingdom of his God. But it's there as a powerful lesson. A momentary slip. A momentary forgetfulness. A lack of glorifying God in his speech. He spoke unadvisedly. And for that he paid so high a penalty. "Every idle word that men shall speak, they shall give account thereof in the day of judgment," says Jesus. Moses was punished. He paid his penalty. It seems a serious penalty to pay. It was paid because of his supreme position in the nation, and he was there as their great exemplar. And Moses, the meekest man of his time, momentarily failed, forgetting the control of his speech. It is an important matter, isn't it, brothers and sisters? We ought to pay attention to it. And this failure of Moses, which we may regard perhaps as a negative one, throws, of course, the whole weight of the matter on the positive side. The object of speech, our speech, should be the glory of God. As everything we do, of course. Whatsoever you do, do it to the glory of God. There are one or two of the passages in the New Testament which have figured for so long in our little epitome of the commandments of Christ, that I suppose they are familiar to us. Let me, however, remind you of two of these. One in the letter to the Colossians, which appears at verses 5 and 6, where the apostle says, "Walk in wisdom toward them that are without, redeeming the time." How often attention has been drawn to the Revised Version alternative here, buying up the opportunity. Do you ever read that without your mind going back to Daniel chapter 2, where we have the origin of this phrase? Men in desperate straits, anxious to tell the king what he demands of them because their lives are at stake, plead for time. "I know that ye would buy the time," he says. Time was what they needed most of all for the anger of this eastern potentate to subside and their lives be spared. And Paul lifts this phrase into his epistle. In short, you are men in danger of perishing unless you supply what the king demands. Buy the opportunity then. Redeem the time. And it's in that context that he says, "Let your speech be always with grace, seasoned with thought, that ye may know how ye ought to answer every man." Revised Version says, "each one." It calls on us not to be ready to give the reasons of our faith and to help all and sundry as we may, but to try to be able to particularize, to know something of the circumstances of each one, and as time and experience grow on our shoulders, to be able to discern what is the need of each one and the better supply that need. There is, of course, no better exemplar of this principle than the Lord himself. In the wonderful words of the 50th chapter of the prophecy of Isaiah, he is said to be able to speak a word in season to him that is weary. It is a worthwhile exercise to go through the records of the conversations which Jesus had with various people. and to note how skillfully and how differently he treated each one of them. He was ready for all and sundry, but he took in the needs of each one's case. He had an insight that you and I don't possess. He had quickened powers that are not ours. And he knew what each case needed and how dexterously he turned the conversation to supply that need. We think of him with the woman at the well of Samaria. A wonderful story, this, which John gives us in the 4th chapter. Jesus came to a place near Sychar, near to the parcel of ground that Jacob gave to his son, Joseph. And Jacob's well was there. We wonder why John goes to the length of telling us these details concerning the place to which Jesus came, how he sat wearied at this particular well of Jacob in the parcel of ground that he gave to his son, Joseph. It's a very holy spot in the land of Israel. The Mounts Ebal and Gerizim are close at hand with their curses and their blessings. It's full of historic significance. All the 12 sons of Jacob were buried there, according to the record of Stephen in the Acts of the Apostles. Jesus was in a place sanctified by the history of the nation of Israel. The fathers of the Jewish race. And he sat by this well and spoke to a Samaritan woman, half Jew, half Gentile. Remember the terms of the blessing of Jacob on Joseph? Joseph is a fruitful bough, even a fruitful bough by a well. Vine, the American Revised Version has it. A fruitful vine by a well, whose branches run over the wall. The archers of Saul shot at him, but his bow abode in strength, and the arms of his hands were made strong by the hands of the mighty God of Jacob. From whence is the shepherd, the stone of Israel? Yes, Jesus was to come from the shepherd, and the stone of Israel was to come from the mighty God of Jacob. Not through the line of Joseph, but the prophecy is inserted there because of the fact that Joseph, of all the sons of Jacob, was the only one with moral worth, which made him in any way fitting for a type of the Lord himself. And so in Joseph's blessing there comes this parenthetical clause, as we find it in Genesis 49, from thence is the shepherd and the stone of Israel and the God of Jacob. Joseph is a fruitful bough by a well whose branches run over the wall. The figure of the vine, of course, is the constant figure of Israel, the fire vine which God brought out of Egypt and planted in his land, but which became a degenerate vine, was cut down to the ground, burnt to the ground, before an 80th psalm tells us, and the psalmist pleads that God's hand might be upon the Son of Man, whom he made strong for himself. Upon the branch which he made strong for himself. And so we have the little shoot that was to come out of the old Davidic and Jesse stock, a root out of a dry ground. I am the true vine, he said. And he sat by Jacob's well in the parcel of ground given to Joseph. And already the branches were running over the wall. And finally, the wall of partition which separated Jew and Gentile was to be completely broken down. And the branches of that vine went out into all the earth. And by the grace of God, has reached us here in these last days. And how he turned the conversation for the woman, arresting first her astonishment, her interest, and at last leading her to partake of the waters of life. So it would seem, at any rate. And of course there came out of Samaria many coming to hear the Messiah and to believe on him. Lift up your eyes, he said. Say not, there's 4 months yet to harvest. The fields are white with harvest. We have a sin, a hymn which celebrates this expansion of the grace of God. Not fully yet. Christ will still instruct his disciples only to go into the, not to go into the way of the Samaritan and into any of the way of the Gentiles, not enter. They were sent to the lost sheep of the house of Israel, whom has had their final opportunity before the grace of God takes its great extending sweep and goes out into all the earth. And then indeed the disciples will receive their instruction. But how he knew this woman's case and developed the conversation for her eternal good. We might think of one or two other cases in which he himself was quite different in his method of approach. Nicodemus comes to him and receives what seems to be rather short and sharp treatment. Nicodemus comes with flattery on his lips. He comes from the rulers of the Jews. He knows how to turn a compliment. Jesus has no time for it. He cuts right through it and comes to the heart and core of the matter right away. Not in quite such abrupt way does he deal with the rich young man who came in all good conscience to ask what he was to do to inherit eternal life. But he had an idol in his heart, which was too great to be forsaken. Jesus led him on. And by a very clever evasion of a full answer to the question which he first of all gave, added the greater weight to what came later, and made the young man see where his real danger lay. And yet he went away, sorrowful, for he had great possessions. John Baptist is one with whom Jesus seems to have dealt in conversation rather roughly. He came, sent messengers to ask whether Jesus was the one who should come, or do we look for another? There's no lack of faith in John, but he is puzzled by the course of events, and he needs to be mollified. And Jesus sends no immediate answer, as you remember. He simply let the messengers of John accompany him for a while, whilst he spoke the gospel to the poor and did many miracles, and sent them back to report in the very terms of Isaiah the work that the Messiah was to do, and sent John a warning, also in the very terms of Isaiah, not to allow himself to be caused to stumble because of his imprisonment and of his inadequate conception of the work that the Messiah should do. And John, who received his commission through the testimony of Isaiah in the first place, who was the subject of Isaiah's prophecy, John would perceive the application of that prophecy. Jesus, you see, knew the strong, robust character of John the Baptist. He knew what sort of treatment John wanted, what sort of message he needed. And his message was adapted to the circumstances of the case. Isn't there a marvel of self-control in the way in which the work of Judas is completely hidden from the rest of the disciples when Jesus gives him his bidding to haste his last great deadly work? No man knew why he spake so to him. Isn't there a marvel of self-control in which he carefully but gently rebuked those disciples who were looking to the right and left hand places in the kingdom when it should come? Isn't there a marvelous skillful treatment by the way in which Jesus restores the confidence of Peter on the shores of Galilee? What a play upon words we have in about three verses in John's record there. First the comparative, lovest thou me more than these? Then the dropping of the comparative, lovest thou me? Then the changing of the Greek term and the lowering of its significance, lovest thou me? The change in the instructions which Peter receives. First of all, feed my lambs. And then, tend. Quite a different word. The first means simply to feed. The second includes all the duties of a shepherd, which are wonderfully defined for us, of course, in the 34th chapter of the prophecy of Ezekiel,
where the shepherds of Israel are indicted for their lack of certain things. Tend my sheep. And then to switch back again to the word feed. Feed my sheep. For all their days they will need this feeding. They will need the skillful handling of a shepherd in their various circumstances of life as they grow from lambs to sheep. First of all, they need succor as lambs. They need to grow to maturity. But the sheep, who were figures of those who would be brought from out of the world, represent the more mature members of the flock, who have passed, some of them, through very bitter experiences in life, who have been hardly hit sometimes by the world's ways and the circumstances which have been befallen them, and who need more than feeding. There's the binding up of the brokenhearted, the seeking out of those that are lost, the healing of those that are sick, and the more desperate cases that are diseased. All these are the work of the shepherd, which was handed over to Peter. It was to be part of his duty. How rich the instructions of the Lord are. How was he able to give such different counsel to so many different cases in so many different strains and with so many different accents? Well, Isaiah has the secret here for us, of course, in this 50th chapter, in which he speaks of him who was so much the disciple that he learned and practiced what his father did and knew the needs of men. The Lord hath given me the tongue of them that are taught. He had an open ear, always ready to hear what his father wanted him to do. But I should know how to speak a word in season to him that is weary. He wakeneth morning by morning. He wakeneth mine ear to hear as them that are taught. Brethren and sisters, have we all got the open ear which morning by morning is ready to hear the divine counsel and act on it? For the context of this is his obedient spirit. The Lord hath opened mine ear, and I was not rebellious. A course was planned for him that was painful indeed. He must needs suffer, and suffer greatly. But I was not rebellious, neither turned away back. I gave my back to the smiters, and my cheeks to them that plucked off the hair. I hid not my face from shame and spitting. For the Lord God will help me. Therefore shall I not be confounded. Therefore have I set my face like a flint, and I know that I shall not be ashamed. And of course it is that which we now once more commemorate. His obedient spirit, which despised the shame, underwent the ignominy of his cruel death, which once more we memorialized. But again, because of his obedient spirit, emerged triumphantly and became the life-giving power, brothers and sisters, for you and for me, if we will be his disciples indeed. Let's remember that every barren word that men shall speak, they shall give account thereof in the day of judgment. And day, by steady progress, seek to build up a character for ourselves that shall be rich and helpful to those that are about us, that in fact we may have the tongue of the disciple.